Hi there. Before we begin, let me explain something. This 12-part series was made at WYSO, a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO's staff and infrastructure to get the job done. We'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Chris Welter. You're listening to the Ohio Country from public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. This is episode 5, called The Fort Ancient Culture.
Most Ohio schoolchildren learn about the prehistoric people who lived in the Ohio River Valley, the Adena, the Hopewell, and the Fort Ancient, which was the most recent.
The Fort Ancient culture thrived for 700 years, until the time Europeans came to North America.
I'm Nina Ellis. Today we're going to hear about the seismic shift. Some would call it the Big Bang when Europeans came to North America, and what happened to the Fort Ancient culture as a result.
From public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio, you're listening to the Ohio Country.
We're in a fourth grade classroom in Springfield, Ohio this morning. It's about 8:30. Some kids are arriving from the cafeteria where they had breakfast. The others listen to music or play video games. And then their teacher calls them to order.
All right, I need you to put your iPads closed and grab a pencil. iPads closed and grab a pencil.
This is Shelley Silverhorn. We met her in episode 3 as she demonstrated how indigenous people in Ohio made maple sugar. Shelley grew up as a citizen of the Navajo tribe, and she's a social studies teacher here at this very diverse public school on the city's south side called Lincoln Elementary.
To the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Today's lunch selection is...
Hi, my name is Andrea. Today for lunch we're having hot dog on a bun, baked beans, applesauce cup, and milk.
Thank you, team.
The Ohio Department of Education creates the teaching standards for all K through 12 public school students. Social studies includes Ohio history for all fourth graders, but they don't all have the chance to hear this lesson from two tribal citizens.
Okay. So, as you can see, we have a presenter. Your focus is going to be on what he says, okay? This is Mr. Silverhorn.
Oh, you guys got the same name.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You have a worksheet to do. There's going to be four topics that he's going to be talking about. Your task is to write one important fact that you heard. Okay?
All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Can y'all hear me? All right. My name is Mr. Silverhorn, and I am going to be talking about Adena, Hopewell, and Fort Ancient cultures today, right? So this is starting off your unit on Native peoples. So we're going to talk about some of the ancestral cultures from here in Ohio that made the modern tribes like we know today. Real quick, before we get started, I always like to introduce myself in my own language. And so to do that, I would say hato. Can everybody say hato? Hato, that's hello. Hato, haku is a la simamo, nehe is a la simamo, kwakila, nila simamo, yellow wakwaki, a paximonki, it took with aki o mallet, Miami, Oklahoma, the Wayne dot Oklahoma, de kwakila, and I'm so holy when I can eat tazido, Nikia, Kerry Silverhorn, Tena with Clint Silverhorn, the Kokochi, Teresa Blue Jacket, the somewhat Lance Silverhorn. Did y'all get all that?
No.
So we're going to talk about three distinct cultures today. You guys can probably see them on your worksheets. The Adena culture, the Hopewell culture, and the Fort Ancient culture. That's what we're going to be talking about today. And our story starts about 2,800 years ago, almost 3,000 years ago, right? Now, there have been people here, Native people in North America, for about 23,000 years. That's a long time. There have been people in Ohio for about 15,000 years, right? It's a lot. But this culture, this Adena culture, starts doing something that's really unique and different. And they start building mounds. Has anybody seen the mounds or know what I'm talking about when I talk about the mounds? Okay, we'll talk about the mounds. But they start this practice of like building these mounds. And then Hopewell people take it, and they go a completely different direction with it. They start building very different mounds. And then Fort Ancient Culture, they're building some mounds too, but their lifestyle is changing. So these are all the same people. Adina, Hopewell, Fort Ancient.
They are all the same people, he says, just living in different times. Many scholars and archaeologists agree. Talon draws those connections for the students. He and Shelley were raised knowing their tribe's history, ceremonies, and traditions, especially hunting, which Talon can easily connect to his forebears.
Talking about hunting, right? So thinking about like deer, here's a deer skeleton. This is all of the stuff that you could get from a deer skeleton. So you can use its bones for things like needles, for knives, for dice, awls, and sewing tools. So here's some deer stuff right here. I'm going to pull out some of this, these tools.
The prehistoric tribes have no written histories, but a rich spoken tradition and abundant archaeological artifacts, evidence of their creative material culture, like finely honed arrowheads and spears, pottery for cooking, and carved ceremonial pipes in the shapes of animals.
So like this pipe right here that I have, this pipe is made out of soapstone, and it's actually fairly plain. Like it just has like a little chimney bowl. But a lot of Hopewell people carved these really nice like birds and snakes and minks and eagles and all kinds of stuff into their pipes. Oftentimes they were buried in mounds like they were people. Pretty cool.
Talon shows the kids drawings of houses the tribes built, the enclosures they made, and their ingenious earthworks, which can still be seen all across Ohio. The kids are transfixed and ask a lot of questions, especially about the early people's daily lives.
Yes.
What do they use to brush their teeth?
That's a really good question. Did everybody hear the question? He asked, what did they use to brush their teeth? So I can tell you that for Shawnee people in history, what we know we used to brush our teeth with is spice bush. Spice bush is a plant that usually grows like along trails. And what we would do is we would break up the ends of one of the twigs, the sticks, into it was like a brush. And it's already like pre-flavored because spice bush tastes like, it smells and tastes like pepper and it's kind of spicy. It's kind of like cinnamon almost. And so using that to clean our teeth, it would be like a flavored toothbrush.
How did they sleep on?
How do they sleep?
Yeah.
So they slept on beds. Their beds were probably made of things like this right here. So I'm going to pass this around and let you guys feel it. But these are beaver skins, right? These are beaver skins. So imagine using this as like a pillow. Can you feel it?
Yeah.
Can you feel how soft it is?
Yeah, it feels like a bear.
That's soft.
Yeah.
That's soft.
Yeah, these are beaver skins. So things like beaver and bear and deer, elk. What else? Do you have a question? What's it?
What did they eat?
What did they eat? So remember we were talking about them growing things? They grew crops of seed-bearing plants. They also collected wild plants and nuts. And that was most of what they ate, right? So most of what people were eating was not what they were hunting. It's what they were growing and what they were foraging. So hunting was a pretty small part of what people ate. Yeah.
Did they ever eat bird?
You guys eat bird? What are you talking about?
We do chicken.
I ate chicken.
Yeah.
We'll be talking more about that tomorrow. Well, right now, what I need you guys to do is make sure your worksheet has your name on it. You're going to come turn it into the tray. Grab your stuff and line up.
Hi, and team, jump. Please report back to the cafeteria.
These fourth graders have a rare chance to learn about Ohio's prehistoric people from tribal citizens who have a deep family connection with the past. It's hard to comprehend the passage of thousands of years and the succession of cultures. But these kids heard this loud and clear. There were people here before us. They lived in collaboration with and manipulated the natural world. They built extraordinary mounds and earthworks, and their descendants are still here. There's no guarantee they will hear this lesson quite this way again by the time they graduate from high school in 2032. You're listening to The Ohio Country from the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. This is episode 5. The Fort Ancient culture was the last to live in southern Ohio. They were here when the Europeans arrived in North America and all hell broke loose. Stephen Warren has studied the Fort Ancient culture for 25 years, working collaboratively with the present-day Shawnee tribes. He teaches at the University of Iowa in the Departments of History and American Studies. One of his books is called The Worlds the Shawnees Made: Migration and Violence in Early America. It describes the Fort Ancient culture in detail and how they fit into the complicated history of early Ohio.
For the listeners out there, I just want you to know that I'm a historian by training. My PhD is in that field. And I'm also non-native. And so I have an outsider's perspective. I'll never know what it means to be a citizen of one of the three federally recognized Shawnee tribes, now resident in Oklahoma. Having said that, I have spent the last about two and a half decades, traveling to Oklahoma and doing my best to understand and appreciate Shawnee culture.
The Fort Ancient culture that you describe in your book has a geographical boundary. On page 30, you have this map, the boundaries of the Fort Ancient world, and it looks to extend from the Muskingum River up near Marietta all the way down to the Kentucky River on its way to Louisville. It includes Portsmouth, Ohio, Ashland, Ohio, Cincinnati, Ohio, and all of those towns along the Ohio River. This was a revelation to me, I tell you, since I live in this region, to know that this was a specific culture. Can you talk a little bit about the characteristics of that culture?
Yeah, I would love to. So across this wide geographic area for about 700 years, Native peoples were small-scale agriculturalists who lived in very close-knit communities. In the summer, they aggregated in communities that were roughly 500 to 1,000 people in size, up and down the branches of the Ohio River Valley. And it was there that they concentrated their efforts on the Three Sisters, that is, corn, beans, and squash. When the fall began, they dispersed into what were called winter, or what we know of as winter hunting camps, which would have been extended family groups of approximately 15 to 30 people. In the very early spring, maple sugaring became another reason to relocate. And so Native peoples would have gathered close to recognized sugar bush regions where they could tap maple sugar trees. And then finally, they would return back to their ancestral summer village and start the cycle over again. And so this seasonal migration across Ohio and Kentucky and West Virginia in pursuit of hunting, fishing, and gathering sustained them for about 20 generations. And one of the characteristics of the Fort Ancient people is that there's very little turnover in the population across this 700-year period. So we know that they had a fairly peaceful lifeway. I'm sure that wars did occur, but we don't see revolutionary changes in demography or population across this 700-year period. So they had a pretty effective lifeway and a means of maintaining peace so that they could continue to pursue this subsistence economy.
700 years is a long time. We have to stop and remember that the United States isn't anywhere near that old.
No.
And it also is a testament to the richness of this region, right?
Yes.
The fertility of the ground and the vibrancy of the animal population and the fact that they didn't have to go all that far in order to spend those three seasons sustaining themselves, right?
Yeah, that's been one of the real joys of doing this research is remembering the land in a different way, being able to reconstruct what the Ohio landscape once looked like before farm tiling and drainage systems and monocrop agriculture transformed the landscape. It was an incredibly abundant land, as you say, and one thing that I've noticed in my historical research is the extent to which Native peoples described the Ohio Valley as an abundant hunting ground. So people traveled here from vast distances. The Mohawk leader Joseph Brant referred to the Ohio Valley as the dish with one spoon. Others referred to it as the common pot. And those metaphors are powerful. They denote the richness of the Ohio Valley and the ability of the region to sustain populations that weren't just from Ohio, but were from elsewhere, places like Michigan and Indiana and our bordering states.
In the meantime, 1,000 miles away in the early 1500s, the Spanish arrive in Florida. And this sets a whole series of events into place that have a devastating effect here in the Miami Valley. I know that the focus of your work is here with the Shawnee, but can you talk a little bit about the broad outlines of what that Spanish arrival meant?
Sure. So Hernando de Soto was the first to travel significantly through North America in 1539 and 1540. He brought with him domesticated animals, disease, guns, horses, and the use of terror. And so one of his practices was abduction, kidnapping, in order to intimidate Native people into following his wishes. The guns at the time period were smoothbore muskets, so they were terribly inaccurate. They weren't used for hunting. They were used for intimidation. If you happen to be struck by one of these guns, you know, you'd have a hole in your body, and this left a pretty significant impact on Native people about the power of Europeans. And so what we see as a result of De Soto is a kind of a rolling impact where people disperse. They were aggregated into large communities, but those communities became vulnerable to attack as European trade goods, namely guns, came into the possession of Native rivals. And so you see a lot of combat between people who possess guns and those who do not. And you also see the emergence of an indigenous slave trade in the aftermath of De Soto's expedition, wherein British folk along the Atlantic coast who arrive shortly thereafter began to first experiment with forced labor of indigenous people. And so some Native Americans become slavers, some Native people become enslaved. And so it's really kind of a multi-pronged attack on Native American cultural systems, from virgin soil diseases such as smallpox and influenza, to the slave trade, to just, you know, military turnover and upheaval. And one of the remarkable things that this does is it takes that 700-year Fort Ancient culture that spanned across 20 generations, and suddenly these people who had been so dedicated to place become mobile. They move and travel vast distances. They live in diaspora by necessity in order to avoid the worst impacts of enslavement and disease and warfare.
So what precipitated that diaspora? Why did they pick up and go? I mean, this Spanish activity was happening well south of them, but they did feel the impact of those diseases and guns from other Native American tribes, right?
That's right. We know that some of the slavers traveled into the Ohio Valley by roughly 1600. And these slaving expeditions were impactful because tribes that were on the eastern coast that were proximate to Europeans had access to European trade goods, and they had access to guns, and they used interior populations to supply them with those needs. So the first human beings to be sort of commodified and objectified and sold to Europeans were interior populations. And so Fort Ancient folk became vulnerable. And to deal with that vulnerability, they did something that a lot of people don't really anticipate, and that is that they moved toward colonizers rather than away from them.
Yeah. Part of you would think they'd go west or go north.
Yeah, go west or retreat into, you know, some misbegotten place. But in fact, the calculus was that we need to travel toward colonizers so that we could be armed. We could have access to those trade goods. And in fact, the modern Shawnee people were recruited to what is Savannah, Georgia, by the English, who wanted them to come there because they had heard that they were good fighters, and they wanted them to displace the Westo, who had become problematic allies of the English. They were indiscriminate enslavers. As they became desperate for human chattel that they could trade, they began launching attacks against Native nations that had formal alliances with the English. And this was not acceptable to the English. And so the Shawnee were invited to the Savannah River region in and around Augusta, Georgia, in roughly 1670, and they destroyed the Westo, and the people who identified as Westo were either killed or sold into slavery themselves, mainly in the Caribbean. And so one aspect of this story that is significant is globalization. We see Native Americans traded well beyond the North American interior into the Caribbean, into Brazil. And so there's quite a traffic in human beings.
So the Fort Ancient people, we're now calling them Shawnee, leave the Ohio Valley. And there's a period of time when it's not heavily populated, right?
Yeah, this is where archaeologists know more. You know, the problem with the archaeological record is that it's based largely on summer villages. If 400 to 500 people live somewhere, it's going to leave a mark on the land. And we can recognize those marks fairly easily. Winter hunting camps are much more difficult to pick up archaeologically. You know, 15, 20, 25 people leave a much lesser imprint on the landscape. And what we hypothesize is that in order to avoid detection and to remain safe, people lived more permanently in what we would call or describe as winter hunting camps. In other words, they first tried aggregating into large defensive communities that had palisades around them, some kind of a defensive buffer. And after that didn't work, they probably dispersed into small winter hunting camps. And we haven't been able to find many of those in the Ohio Valley. So it's difficult to know how many people stayed behind and how many people traveled into toward colonizers.
Right. Nevertheless, we have this year 1720, which a lot of people
yes.
refer to as the return of the Shawnee. Can you talk about that a little bit, this return? They come back and they're several villages in southern Ohio.
That's right. That's right. So the first village that is widely known is at the confluence of the Scioto and Ohio rivers, and that's called Lower Shawnee Town. It is a Shawnee village, that is to say that a majority of the people who live there identify culturally as Shawnee, but it's also the case that it's a multi-ethnic community that is affiliated with English traders. So when Shawnee people return, they return with kin from other tribal communities that reflect their journeys across North America. And they return to a land that has been sparsely populated and as a result is very abundant in animals, plants. And so the richness of that makes the Ohio Valley between roughly 1720 and 1790 a doubly abundant dish with one spoon, a place that that can sustain large returning groups of people who once identified Ohio as their homeland.
You know, I'm sure you know about this new state park that's going in here in Greene County. We're very excited about it. And it's on the site of this former Shawnee village. And everybody I've talked to, all of the tribal people who know about the history, describe a life there that sounds exactly like what you have described the Fort Ancient life to be. It's along the river. The women are engaged in agriculture. The men are out hunting. They leave in the winter for hunting camps and maple sugaring. And it sounds so similar to what had happened hundreds and hundreds of years before.
Yes, I would generally agree with that. One thing that's hard to recapture is the Native American philosophy related to the land, its flora and fauna. And it's important, I think, to try and recall what that might have looked like. And so Native peoples consider themselves to be quite literally in relationship to the land. So, for example, their clans are named after animal ancestors, many of whom they believe are quite literally their ancestor. Many origin stories feature the role that animals play in the creation and survival of Native people in the land. There are medicines that can only be ingested with the infusion of maple sugar. And so to live in a place is to be in relationship to it. And there is really this philosophy of having a kind of a reciprocal, respectful commitment to the flora and fauna. And for Native Americans, they grant that flora and fauna personhood. And so considering that they're sentient beings, that they have thought, that they make decisions, that they have souls, that they too, like people, are part of their own tribes. And so this philosophy is one that we observed but didn't quite fully appreciate at the time.
Or still.
Right.
I mean, the way agriculture developed in so many ways doesn't understand those connections. I think it's fair to say. You live in an agricultural society there in Iowa as well, and you see these big industrialized farm fields and chemicals. And I have to say I'm pretty excited to participate in what I hope will be workshops and exhibits that describe that relationship more deeply so that young people can learn about that. It's bringing a whole layer of thought back to Ohio, I think.
Right. So in Ohio, you know, one of the goals that Native people would have would be to restore those plants and animals to the state because that's where they belong. That's where they evolved. That's the land they know. So species replacement is one big impact of the changes wrought by colonization.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that summary. I'm really, thank you for your scholarship. I've just found it so absorbing, totally absorbing.
Thank you.
University of Iowa professor and author, Dr. Stephen Warren.
We've set the stage for a complicated and fascinating period in the Ohio country, the 1700s, when the region is totally transformed. French and British explorers and traders come here, where many native tribes are living. And then after decades of war between the different parties and the many tribes, the new American government takes control of the Ohio country.
The U.S., I would say the Old Northwest is really set up to create violence over the territory. So the new United States Empire is premised on an idea that it will acquire Indian land. And that's not going to happen naturally or easily or quickly. It requires a great deal of blood and treasure to make that a reality.
That's coming up in episode 6 of The Ohio Country from the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
That was episode 5 of The Ohio Country called The Fort Ancient Culture. It was written by Nina Ellis. Thanks to Lincoln Elementary School in Springfield, Ohio, and to Iowa Public Radio. The editor of The Ohio Country is Samantha Summer. The cultural advisor is Dr. John Bickers, assistant professor at Case Western University and a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Flawn Williams is the audio mixer, and the composer is Evan Miller. Our logo was designed by Layla Troyer, a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. I'm the digital producer, Mary Evans. To find photographs, maps, and links, go to wyso.org/podcast. This program is made possible through a partnership with Ohio Humanities, a nonprofit that shares stories to spark conversations and inspire ideas, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, a More Perfect Union Initiative. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Ohio Humanities or the National Endowment for the Humanities.
To see visual content related to the Ohio Country, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And for a full transcript of every episode made by humans, go to wyso.org.
Hello again. Now that you've heard this episode, let me explain again. This 12-part series was made at a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio called WYSO. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO staff and infrastructure to get the job done. So we'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org.